Mark chapter 8. Last time, so quick recap. Last time, we spoke about a very interesting couple encounters. You know, we've talked in the past about quite a few amazing things that happened. We have Jesus with Jairus, we have a girl being raised from the dead, we have lepers being healed, we have amazing stories of actually, like, even other stuff of, like, you know, the woman who wanted her, I believe it was her daughter, to be, like, undemon possessed, and she comes and she has, like, no right of her own, the Syrophoenician woman. And then you have, like, a blind guy who's healed because of the fact that, like, Jesus is just good. So we have all these amazing encounters. We have these things of seeing people without any deserving feature or deserving a piece of themselves, just being loved and just accepted and forgiven and taken care of by God who's come. And so when we moved into chapter 8 right here, to quickly kind of overview, because we're focusing on the end of it today, but it's kind of funny. We see Jesus feeding a multitude again. We actually already saw that happen earlier. That happened in the book of Mark, and we also see it happen in the other gospels. But this is, I found this funny, a scholar that I read a commentary of, he points out this is not a, like, redundant story. This is not like Mark forgot that he told that Jesus fed the multitude and then is telling it again. This is not the same multitude. At first, I didn't really think that that would be perhaps a thought, like, oh, well, maybe this is redundant. But the guy points out, some people think that this is the same story, which it's not. He actually did more than one multitude feeding. And it's interesting that it's not the same story because of the fact that this was an opportunity for the disciples to trust, right? Jesus fed the multitude, remember? Jesus broke bread and tore up bits of fish and gave it out. And the multitude, 5,000 people were fed. And now, similar group of people, large quantity, lacking of food, and Jesus does again. And the commentator points out that this is an opportunity for the disciples to trust because God's already done this literal miracle earlier. And they don't. And once again, they're afraid, Lord, we can't feed them. What are we going to do? And they don't know what to do. And Jesus tells them, like, really? I can do this. I have this. I've done this. And he does it again. And he multiplies the food so that there's leftovers again. Food in abundance in the presence of Christ. Then, moving on from there, Jesus gets on a boat. He goes to a place called Dalmanutha, which I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that right. It's just a place. And when he's there, the Pharisees once again attack him and they fight him. Not, again, verbally. They don't ever, like, physically attack him till the end of the gospel. And they just get in this another argument and fight with him. And they're telling him, I'm sorry, I have to laugh. This is just so ironic. They're saying that we want a sign. Give us a sign that you are who you say you are. Show us, prove to us that you are the Messiah. Like, did they not know that he fed 4,000 and 5,000 people? Have they not seen the blind men healed? Have they not seen the leper cleansed? Have they not been there? Like, Jesus made a man walk who was crippled, and literally it's prophesied in the Old Testament that the lame will leap in the presence of the Messiah. Like, how blind could you be? You know the statement, like, seeing the forest for the trees, or like you just don't catch it. It's right in front of you. And they want a sign. And Jesus is actually off-put. He's upset. He leaves frustrated at the interaction with them and gives a stern warning to the disciples who are, okay, and this is, I have to say this. It's really easy to pick on the disciples. Like, it's really easy at times to just kind of shake our head and be like, really, guys? Seriously? Jesus fed the multitude again and you didn't get it? But how many times has God taken care of us in our lives? How many times has God pulled us out of a terrible situation or picked us up after we have been completely fallen apart? And then something else arrives, and what do? We panic, we crumble, we flip out as if God did not sustain us in our previous trial. So it's easy to pick on the disciples, but the reality is that I think of the disciples as they are us incarnate in the story. This is us. This is what we do every time the enemy attacks us. If you don't, amen. God bless you. I am so encouraged to know that you do not fall apart. But for me, I need to be picked up day by day because I always fall apart. I always freak out. I know he can do great things and I panic still. and it's just ridiculous of me. But this is where Jesus gives them a stern warning because of the fact that he doesn't want them to be like the Pharisees. Jesus doesn't want the disciples to. He doesn't want them to see the world as the Pharisees do. You know, the Pharisees see the world not as it really is, which is weird because they're the religious leaders of the time. They see the world, I mean, they look down on people. They have like this higher, like, I am holier than thou mentality. And really, I think that when I say that they see the world, is that they see the meaning of life in the face, and they don't respond to it. And the reason why is because of their religiosity. Remember, in this chapter, Jesus says, don't let like the leaven of the Pharisees, like the yeast, don't let it corrupt the bread. And the point of that here, actually, I'm going to read that part specifically. He says, he commanded them, watch out, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod. They were discussing amongst themselves that they did not have any bread. He's talking about, be aware of the yeast of the Pharisees. And they're like, we don't have bread. It's like, that's not the point. Aware of this, he said to them, why are you discussing that you don't have bread? Don't you understand or comprehend? Is your heart hardened? Do you have eyes and not see, or do you have ears and not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets fulls of bread did you collect? 12, they told him. When I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many large baskets did you collect? 7. And he said to them, don't you understand yet? And the thing is that Jesus is performing the miracles. Jesus is performing the signs. He's doing the things that the Messiah would do when he arrives. And the Pharisees, in their religiosity, cannot see that the Messiah is right in front of them. And this is why Jesus says, beware the yeast of the Pharisees, that your own goodness could keep you blind to my goodness. It could keep you blind to true beauty because of self-righteousness. That is a warning that I need. I think we all need to hear that. We all need to be warned of that. And that actually ties in very key with our topic today. So then Jesus heals a blind man again. As far as I believe this text, this is the second blind man. Could be the third. I might be miscounting. And finally, we get to the focus of our chapter, and that is the end when Jesus asks the disciples, who do people say that I am? And then goes on after the response to, rebuke Peter, and then say a very, very, I don't know why I always choose very intense topics. I'm really sorry. But he says, take up your cross. I've actually been listening to the sermon series of another church, and they have this almost similar kind of topic or series, and they literally called it Come and Die. It's very intense. It's very heavy, but in a good and necessary way. So we are going to focus on verse 27 through 38, which is, I will read, Jesus went out with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the road he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? They answered him, John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. But you, he asked them again, who do you say that I am? Peter answered him, you are the Messiah, or you are Christ. And he strictly warned them to tell no one about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, be killed and rise after 3 days. He was openly talking about this, so Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning around and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, because you're not thinking about God's concerns, but man's. Summoning the crowd along with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone wants to be my follower, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life because of me and the gospel will save it. For what does it benefit a man to gain the whole world yet lose his soul? What can a man give in exchange for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. I skipped something. When he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. No, I did not. Sorry, verse 9, just like it moves right into chapter 9 super fast. Because then he says, then he said to them, I assure you, there's some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God come to power. So like I said, I've decided another heavy topic. I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry because I love these things because I think at times, almost as a Christian, I overlook sections like this now because, this couldn't apply to me, right? I'm not I'm not ashamed of the gospel. You would think that I especially am not because I'm standing up here telling people about it. So it wouldn't seem like there's any sort of negative view or like kind of like hiding mentality on my part. But it's just, there's more to it, I think, and that's why I wanted to focus on it. Because this is really one of the most radical statements, I would say, of the gospel. It really is. It's a big question, really. It's a very central question that I think the gospel, that I think the Bible, that I think Christ is asking to each and every one of us. And that question is, what am I seeking? What am I after? What is the goal of what I'm doing? What's my end game, right? Like, what am I trying to get to happen? And I actually would think that that question, within the context of what the Bible says, within the context of who Jesus is, within that context, it really leads me to the 3 points, but really I think of it as 3 questions. Am I seeking to save my life? 1. Am I seeking to save my life through spirituality? 2. And finally, am I seeking to lose my life? Right? Am I seeking to save my life? Am I seeking to save my life spiritually or through spirituality? And am I seeking to lose my life? So, let's move in. If anyone wants to be my follower, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. It's kind of backwards, right? Kind of like, what is that? Like, have you guys heard the term, like, opposite day? Like, when you say, like, oh, well, the opposite is, like, the case today. Who would ever think, like, if you want to save your life, you'll lose it. But if you lose your life, you'll save it. That just kind of seems like the opposite. It's like, wait a second, if you try and, like, die, obviously you're not going to save your life. It just seems like a backwards mentality. But Jesus here, there's something deeper going on. Just in case, like, we thought that that was just kind of, like, circular or, like, this weird kind of, like, opposite argument. It's actually, when you look at the context of their culture and our culture, I think that we get a better idea of what's going on here. So in their culture, we've talked about this, it's shame and honor, right? There's many, many problems in Jewish culture at this time. There's many, many problems just in our culture at our time. But really, and at the time, picking up your cross was not something that you or I ideally would ever do. To pick up your cross was not a good thing. In fact, remember when we see somebody carrying a cross in the Bible, we see Jesus later on carrying a cross, and people are all watching as he's being publicly shamed. That's what that is. That's a shaming. He's being led mostly naked, carrying a big piece of like wood and tree up a hill in front of everybody, and as they're watching and like spitting and like calling out like terrible things of him. So to pick up your cross is not honor, like, it's not an honoring thing to do. That's not something that somebody who is honored or who is honoring another would ever do. Especially in that culture, that was actually that would be akin to accepting the death of a shameful slave. And so to kind of point this further, like the difference between our culture and theirs, we're very individualistic, right? I mean, in our culture today, it's kind of like, I know for me and for people my age, it's really about what I can do. Will I be successful? What I can achieve on my own, where I can get with my own means and efforts. And it's kind of like countercultural to the culture back then, because really you just inherited your family's life. That's pretty much what happened. You know, the oldest son would inherit everything from the father. It, like, a family business literally was the family business, and it went on for generations in that time. A father would bequeath his, like, everything to his oldest son, and then so on, and then so on, and so on. You would always, that would just be what you did. But, well, my father was a farmer, so I'm a farmer. My son will be a farmer. That was just the nature of culture, because in that culture, you were seeking to be honored or honor others through family and through those other types of means. Sorry, by other types of means, I mean you were seeking to honor them, your family, and find honor because you were a good son, because you continued the family business. Well, you made your family profitable. That was how you became honored. Now, in our culture today, that's not really the case, right? I mean, if I continue on the legacy of my parents, I mean, that's good, but nobody in our culture would actually ever say that you have to do that. That is your responsibility, and if you don't carry on the legacy of your parents, you failed society. You haven't done what society has asked you to live up to. No, today it's actually quite the opposite. Well, you don't have to carry the family legacy. You can just be who you are. Be true to yourself. Stand up for yourself. Be who you want to be. And that will give you meaning. That will give you a place in society, as long as who you think you should be. And you know, it doesn't matter what other people think of you, as long as you are who you want to be. I mean, that's definitely countercultural to the time back then. But one more thing to point out is that in the culture, let's quickly dive on this. The Pharisees, the disciples, the Jews, the Messiah was a sought figure. He was an expected person. He wasn't a mystery, but his coming was not unknown in the sense that they anticipated it. That was the desire, is that the Messiah would come. The Jews were waiting for the Messiah to arrive. That was what they all were waiting for, and especially they were waiting for it because they were under the thumb of the Romans. They were oppressed. They were literally a people living underneath another society. They were ruled, as it were, by the Romans. And what the Messiah was going to come and do for them, the Jewish belief was that the Messiah was going to come and liberate them. He was going to come and topple the Roman Empire. He was going to come and topple every empire that would try to take down or to put the Jews underneath them, and the Messiah would come and turn the tables and bring revolution, actually. Military revolution was not, it was misguided literally, but that was what they all expected. That was what they thought was going to happen, was a military reform that the Jews would then be on top because of the Messiah. And actually, in this text, Peter is an example of somebody expecting that. And we'll get back to that. But just note, Peter is one of these people. He is us. He's the people. But let's go back to the culture idea, because I want to focus on one of the cultural aspects in particular. So shame and honor culture back then, you got meaning through your family. You got meaning through carrying on your family's legacy. You got meaning through honoring your parents. That gave you meaning in society. And as I mentioned, today that's not the case. You can find meaning in wealth, you can find meaning in fame, you can find meaning in power, but most of all, I think you find meaning in love, or that's what we think, right? That's what we go after. And I say all those first three, I actually put down points of like all four of those, but really, I feel like love kind of, it really almost in a way encompasses all of them, right? Because why? Because we think that if we have a lot of power, the first one, that people will love us and respect us, right? That we'll get meaning because we're powerful. Well, I'm a powerful person. I've spent my life accumulating power and wealth and fame, etc. So I'm worthwhile. This is what I keep coming back to in the other studies and in the other chapters, right? But it's like this worthwhileness that the culture really seems today to be putting on us. Like it really, in our culture today, we seek to be worthwhile. We seek to be meaningful. It, actually, the way that I thought about this in like kind of like terms is like, it's like you haven't had a meaningful life if you haven't experienced true love. You haven't had a meaningful life if you haven't been able to fly to the Bahamas or like to Hawaii or experience the tropics in some other place. Like you just haven't really experienced life. Your life isn't really meaningful unless you can contribute to society, unless the person you vote for gets into power, you haven't really lived a meaningful life. If you're on the other side of these circumstances, then you haven't had a meaningful life. Like that's really what it kind of comes down to is, have I had a meaningful life? And one of the number one ways I think that we define our meaning is through love. I personally think that's one of the, like probably the biggest way that we define our meaning. And I don't know if you all would agree with me, but personally, I know for me, and I know for plenty of others, that it's almost like the problem at the bottom of the problem. Like, the actual issue, right? Like, you know, if you have, like, a bruise or, like, internal bleeding, how, like, you'll see, like, at the top of the skin, there's, like, a sign of it? But that's not actually the problem. That's not the issue. There's something deeper going on. And I think that at the root of our problem, love is often the issue, because we want to be loved. We want to be accepted. In fact, in our culture today, we want to be accepted regardless of who we are. You know, I've had this conversation with my father and a couple other people, but you know, the funny thing to me is that the term, or like the phrase, like natural inclination, well, I'm naturally inclined to this. And we tend to want to justify, well, you know, that's just natural. It's natural that I feel that way. And you can't judge me because that's the natural inclination. I naturally want to be this way. Okay, well, I naturally don't want to care about anybody. Naturally, like to my nature alone, I'd rather be by myself, away from everybody, doing what I want. Naturally, in my state of naturalness, I'd rather cut you off on the freeway because I want to get to where I want to get first. Naturally, that's just by nature who I want to be. That's not a good person, by the way. I'm not describing like virtues. I'm describing, though, but by my very nature, I'm not a very good person. And yet we always seem to hear it said, well, you know, it's natural, as like an excuse for bad behavior. Well, it's good because it's natural. It's your natural desire. Well, then the Bible must be counter-natural then, isn't it? Or, as it said, supernatural. Like what the Bible tells us to do is super. It's above natural. It tells us to live differently than our very nature inclines us to. But we want to be loved, and we want to be accepted in our naturalness, which is flawed, right? In our sinfulness, we want to be loved, we want to be accepted, and we seek that love from others and from those other things, from wealth, from power, from fame. I think fame is a great example because, I mean, if you're a famous person, obviously you probably have like fan clubs or you have groups of people who like totally like are buying into like whatever you are a part of. If you're like an actor, if you're like a teacher or you're some like philosopher, like, yeah, you probably are loved. People have like this love for you, but like that love just doesn't last, right? Like they don't truly know you. They love, have you guys ever watched like a movie that you love this character? Like, oh, that character is just such a good character. You've read a book and this character is so good. I think the movie is the better example because it's an actor playing that person and they're not actually that person. Like, have you ever had to like totally like, okay, you are not that person. Like the actor who, if you guys saw The Lord of the Rings, the actor who plays Gandalf is not Gandalf. Like, he's not. Like, Gandalf in the book is different than that, but, like, that guy's just not him. He's a guy playing him. And you can love Gandalf, but that doesn't mean that you actually love that guy. You love his role of it. So, really, you don't know him. You just love what he's done. Sorry, that's a weird tangent, but that's, like, see, love comes in different, we have, like, these different avenues in which we try to receive love. In fact, though, a man named, William Vanstone wrote this book in the past called The Phenomenology of Love. And essentially, he just talks about how love is pretty much how there's true and fake love. And no matter what, we all are seeking true love. But true love is unconditional. True love, I love talking about true love, actually. I love the topic of true love. Because true love is very odd in the reality of a loving relationship. Because true love, I mean, when you love somebody and they love you back, that feels great, right? Like, that's the ideal. If you're gonna get married, you want them to love you. Like, you love them, you want them to love you, and you love each other, then you get married. But true love is loving regardless of if they love you. That's what true love is. Love, when you need somebody to love you, and by that means of them loving you, you love them, that's not true love. That's conditional. That the condition of them loving you aids your love. So that means that your love can't necessarily exist perfectly if they don't love you. So true love would have to love regardless of receiving love. The quote that I have here is that, in false love, your aim is to use the other person to fulfill your happiness. Your love is conditional. You give it only as long as the other person is affirming you and meeting your needs. And it's non-vulnerable. You hold back your love so that you can cut your losses if necessary. But in true love, your aim is to spend yourself and use yourself for the happiness of the other because your greatest joy is that person's joy. What love looks like this? Oh my goodness. Therefore, your affection is unconditional. You give it regardless of whether you're loved. One is meeting your needs, and it's radically vulnerable. You spend everything, holding nothing back, giving it all away. What love is like that? Like, what love of, like, a person that you know could you say is exactly like that? And if you could say that somebody has that kind of love, I would encourage you to follow the mentality that maybe that person is diving in to the love of the Trinity, to the love of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, to the love of Christ. Because the reality is that we all need love, right? Like, we are almost like a pool of, like, neediness when it comes to love. We need it within power, wealth, fame. We need it. We need to be loved and accepted. But have you guys ever heard the phrase, like, to be fully loved but not known is a lie? It's not real because they don't know you. How can they love you if they don't really know who you are? And then to be fully known but not loved is our greatest nightmare. If somebody knew me to the bottom, I would expect that they wouldn't love me. And that's exactly what I'm afraid of, is that if you knew me, if you truly knew who I was, you would hate me. You'd be disgusted by me, and you wouldn't love me. But to be fully known and fully loved, that's the love that will change your life. That's the love that will do something beyond. That's the love that we've all been searching for. We want the love that knows us to the bottom, but loves us to the sky, right? That's what we want. We need somebody, though, who can give us love with no need of receiving love. We need Jesus. Because Jesus doesn't need us to love him, right? He has love within the Trinity. He has love within the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He doesn't need our love to love us. He has an overflow of love for us. He is so loved within the Trinity that he just pours out his love upon us. And that's kind of getting ahead of ourselves right here, because the reality is that we all are seeking to be loved. Whether we're seeking to be loved through power, wealth, or fame, I personally believe that we are all seeking to be loved and accepted. And really, at the end of the day, we have a works-based mentality on being loved. We have an achievement-based mentality on doing love. Well, I've worked hard, or I've earned. Have you ever said that? Man, when I think about the times that, like, I've, like, almost been like, I deserve your love. Like, wow. Like, then I guess I'm kind of missing what love is, right? Because love is something that, like, I would hope wouldn't come by my own efforts and actions, because I typically fail it. But I would say that we all are seeking. I would actually say this. I believe we are all seeking to save our own life. And I would say that love is one of the greatest means in which we try and save ourselves. Or find salvation. Maybe that's a better way to put it. We all try and find salvation through the love of others. Maybe it's through a group of people. Maybe it's through that one person who, that if they just acknowledged you, if they just gave you the time of day, your life would have meaning. But if you're seeking to save your own life, if you're seeking love to be saved, then you can't really love somebody else if that's what you're seeking, right? Because that's what's on the other side of that. If you love me, or if I love you, I need you to do this for me. That's like the conditions, right? Love is conditional in those situations. When you say to somebody, I'll love you as long as you love me. Okay, well, you've just set the condition. My love is sustained by your love for me. Or really, when you are seeking, as I think we are in love and romance, when you are seeking to save yourself, it's really, the goal is the thing on the other side, right? Love is just a means to an end. Love is just a means to feeling accepted. That's really what you're seeking. You're seeking to feel accepted and loved. And guess what? Love is the vehicle which gets you to that end. And really, you've lost sight of love. You've just used it. In a sense, you've abused it. Book The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. There is I don't know if you guys have ever read it. It is a fantastic book. To quickly tell you, it's a book about people who are in hell coming to a middle plane, of like a plane outside of heaven, and people from heaven coming down to meet these people and to try and encourage them out of hell, to try and bring them into heaven, to try and give them the opportunity to change and not be who they were and who they are and enter into the kingdom. And the characters, the topics, the just words are incredibly moving. They are heartbreaking, and more often than not, they're tragic. And there's one character in particular who's known as the artist. And there's this man, and as he's in these planes, he's looking around, and all he wants to do is paint them. And actually, a really funny little note is he says, "God," looking around at the planes, like, "Oh, God, like, wow." And the spirit who is from heaven looks at him and says, "God, what?" And he looks at him, he's like, "What do you mean, God, what?" He's like, "Well, God is a noun where we're from. Like, God, what? What does God do? What God does what in this situation?" And he goes like, "Oh, no, I meant like by gum," or like, "Oh my," like, and so it's just kind of like the spirit comes from the heaven side. It comes from that side. I just thought that was like a funny little like, yeah, like that he has such a mind around God. So the artist is looking around. He's looking at the planes and he wants to paint them. And that's what he wants to do. And the spirit says, "Well, you have something else you need to do. You can't really focus on painting right now because you have to go to heaven. You have to go up the mountain, which is where heaven is." And the painter says, "Well, I want to paint this, though. That's what I want to do." And the spirit, so it's a spirit and ghost. Ghost is from hell, spirit is from heaven. And the spirit says to the ghost, "Well, there'll be time for painting later on, but you can't see the planes clearly. And right now, you want to paint the planes, but you can't capture the beauty as well as all of us are experiencing it. Like, we are in the presence of what you're trying to paint. Like, how could your painting ever supersede the subject of the painting?" So the guy gets kind of like caught off guard, like, "Oh, well, I want to paint though. Will that be allowed in heaven?" And the spirit's like, "Yeah, of course it will be allowed. But you see, you used to paint because you wanted to share the little glimpses of heaven that you experienced with other people." And the artist says, well, yeah, that's how I started. But now I would just paint because that's what an artist does. And the spirit says, "Well, you can't experience a place if all you want to do is go there to paint it." But the artist says, "Well, that's exactly what we do, though. We just want to paint those things. That's the point of artists, of being an artist, of art." And the spirit says, "That's not how you began, though. You didn't want to paint the place to paint the place. You wanted to paint the place to tell people about the place, to share the place with them." And at the end of this back and forth between the artist and the spirit, the artist asks, "Well, will I meet distinguished people in heaven?" And the spirit's like, "Well, yeah, well, everybody's distinguished. We're all distinguished in heaven." And the guy's like, "Well, yeah, obviously. But like, well, like these famous artists, well, Plato, will I meet him? Will I meet, or like, sorry, artist isn't just painting. It's actually like, you know, like mythology or other like arts in other forms." He's like, "Well, I meet all these people." And he's like, "Well, yeah, if they're here." He's like, "Well, don't you know? Aren't they famous?" He's like, "Well, no, nobody's famous in the presence of God." Like, he's like, "We're all just light and mirrors. We're just mirrors of light. And the light is the real beauty, and we just reflect it. So we're not really famous. The light is famous." And the man, hearing that his works will not be renowned, backs away and turns from going to heaven back to hell. And he leaves the opportunity to go to heaven and returns to hell. And really what you see there is that the man seeking to be an artist, wanting to do art was not what his goal was. Art was a means to an end. He wanted to be distinguished. He wanted to be amongst those famous people. Actually, the closing argument with him and the spirit is the man says, "Well, wait a second. Won't people know who I am?" And the spirit says to him, "No, nobody will buy your or my work right now." He's like, "Don't you know on earth, your like books and my books, nobody's buying them? We've been forgotten. We've moved on. Like, people don't care about us. We are just a vapor." And the man's like, no, that can't be. I have to go back and I have to write another article. People have to know. And he turns around because we see that art was just a means to an end. It wasn't the end in and of itself. And what Jesus says, all of that, to bring it back around here, what Jesus is saying in this question, "Those who would seek to save their life will lose it," is what's on the other end? What is on the other end? And what is the means by which you're getting to there? Are you seeking to save your life? Is that really what you're after? Because guess what? If that's what you're after, whatever means you use to get there is just a means to a different end. It is just a means to your actual goal. It's not really what you're about. And really, the question that he puts, are you seeking to save your life through love, through romance, through wealth, through power? Are you seeking to find the meaning that will give you, the meaning of life that will give you meaning? Are you finding the thing that will give you acceptance, meaning, and love? Are you seeking to save your life? Now, quickly, because I actually have to, that point was far longer than I expected. I have to quickly go through the next ones, but this one is short anyways. Are you seeking to save your life spiritually? This is weird. This is really a weird thing to say, but I have to ask this question because of the fact that I am a person who I discovered fell under this umbrella. I didn't think so at first, and I didn't think it was anything. I didn't even realize that this concept existed. But whoever loses his life because of me and for the gospel will save it, Mark 8:35. Notice that Jesus doesn't say, whoever loses his life for me. He says, whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel. Like, the gospel is part of it. The gospel is another thing. It's me and the gospel will save it. Now, this is the reality that I had to come to terms with, and this is what I mean. I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to burn in hellfire, and I don't want to go there. And I assume that none of you do either. I don't assume that anybody wants to go to hell. I don't think that's ever anything we actually want. And if you say you want to, I think you're lying. Because I think if you knew what it really was, you would never say, I want to go there. I want to be there. I want to, you know, you ever heard the phrase like, oh yeah, well, I'll have a party in hell. It's like, no, you won't. Hell is like gnashing of teeth and like, it's like fire and burning. And to calm another, or to just kind of quell another misguided notion, hell is not Satan's domain. I have heard this many times that the belief like, oh yeah, well, you know, Satan rules hell. No, he does not. Satan is not the ruler of hell. If you think he is, I'm sorry, he is not. He is an occupant. So just as there are prisoners who are in hell, people who are sinners, guess what? Satan is one of them. He is captive of hell, not ruler. He's not in charge. He is subjugated in hell, which is actually really great because that means that he's put away. Just had to quell that. I've met so many people who see Satan as like the ruler. I'm like, no, that's not who he is. So to get back on point though, I didn't want to go to hell. I don't want to go to hell. And what did Christianity offer me? Hey, you right there. You want to go to heaven? Well, tell me more. Well, do you not want to go and burn in eternal fire? Yeah, no, I don't want to do that. You're right. I do not want to go there. Well, do you want to be saved from all of your failures and stupidities? Yeah, that sounds great, right? Like, that sounds awesome. That's exactly, yes, I want that. Like, if that was a sales pitch, I would buy into it. I would be like, totally, yes, I'm all about that. And in fact, I did. And so I became a Christian. This is literally my backstory. I became a Christian because I didn't want to go to hell. That's why I became a Christian. And I encourage you to understand that I became a Christian for the completely wrong means. I implore you to think about this because this is something that I have had to think, process, and pray out of my system. Because Christianity was my means to an end. Christianity was my vehicle out of hell. Christianity was my escape. Obviously, that is what Christianity is offering. But my desire was to go to heaven and not to go to hell. What's the Christian? Why are we named Christians? Because we are to be desiring Christ. Because Christ should be the thing at the end of the journey that we are after. Christ should be the end point of our, like, he should be the goal. And I became a Christian not with Christ being what I desired at the end. I became a Christian with salvation from hellfire being what I wanted. And you know what that means? That means that Jesus was a means to an end. Even within the blanket of Christianity, Jesus was a means to my own personal end. I obeyed the Bible. I obeyed the Ten Commandments to the best of my ability. I listened to what the Word said. I tried not to be rude to others. I've worked so hard to be this good person, all because I wanted to escape hell. And really, when I think about it, at the end of the day, I was a good person. I was selfless for the most selfish means. And it completely falls apart. I sought to save my life through spirituality, and I implore you to understand, as I do today, that it doesn't work. that you are still, if you are using Christianity to avoid hell, if you are using Christianity to just get to heaven, if you're using your good works inside Christianity, then you are still within the scope of seeking to save your own life. And I'm not trying to put any of you down. I'm not trying to discourage you away from the Bible. I'm not even saying that you're not a Christian necessarily. Because like mentioned in the book of the Great Divorce, in that, one thing that the angels, that the spirits always are doing is saying, you've come this far, you've entered the doors, you're in the valley, just come a little further. Just come a little closer. Just draw a little nearer. That will all fade away. So you can, like me, enter into Christianity with the most selfish means, with the means of avoiding your own termination. And God is so good. Because even if you enter on the wrong premise, even if you begin it with using Jesus as a means to an end, we get chapters like this. We get verses like this of Jesus saying, mm-mm, that's not gonna work. Don't you see that you are still within the same system of seeking to save yourself? Jesus says, I don't want you to simply shift from one performance-based identity to another. I want you to find a whole new way. I want you to lose the old self and the old identity and base yourself and your identity on me and the gospel. Like I said, that's the thing I've struggled with for years. And I thank the Lord that he opened my eyes and that he can open our eyes and that he can pull us out of that, because we all are seeking to save our lives in some way or another. And we all can be, as I was, in Christianity, attending church, saying the right things, teaching a Bible study, and yet still fully be trying to save ourselves through teaching a Bible study, through attending church, through my good behavior, even within the umbrella of Christianity. And that's where, honestly, that's a really big example of what the Pharisees were. They had the knowledge. They had the pulpit. They had the followers. They had the renown. And they had the God that we all have. And they were seeking to save their own lives. Are you seeking to save your life? Are you seeking to save your life through spirituality or through your spiritualness? And now in closing, are you seeking to lose your life? I don't mean anything suicidal. I don't mean anything like that. Let me quickly point that out. This is not one of those studies like cultish. We're going to all go out and we're going to have a big night where we're all just going to go to heaven. No, nothing like that. This is the question of the gospel, though. Because see, if you're seeking to save your life, that is your goal. That is what is the end goal, the end desire. But if you're seeking to lose your life, or if you're seeking to lose your life for my sake and the gospel, then you shall find it. C.S. Lewis is brilliant, and I've already quoted him once, but C.S. Lewis says, okay, for one, this is not, you can't trick God, FYI. You can't be like, all right, God, I'm seeking to lose my life so that, like, you know, I'll have life. It's like, no. It's not like you can, like, really, like, yeah, I'm totally seeking to lose my life. Like, we can't be pretentious around God, right? He knows us. He knows us to the bottom. But the question that Jesus puts here, and really, let's get back. I mentioned Peter. Peter rebukes Jesus when Jesus says, I must suffer and I must die. Why? Because Peter, like all of us, or like me, maybe not all of us, but like me especially, Jesus was a means to an end. Jesus was the Messiah who was going to topple Rome and move from power to power to power, right? It was just going to be an upward climb. He'd defeat the Roman Empire, most likely defeat all the enemies in that area, and then go on to conquer the world. That's what the Messiah was doing. He was a divine figure. It wasn't out of his reach to do those things. And when Peter hears that this Messiah, this very same God that he's been expecting his whole entire life to come and save them all, is going to die and suffer, Peter could not have it. And he pulls Jesus aside and rebukes him. And what does Jesus say? This is big. Like, it's not necessarily a rebuke against Peter, but it's a rebuke against the mentality. He says, get behind me, Satan, because you're not thinking about God's concerns, but man's. When we are seeking to save our own life, we are thinking about man's concerns. When we are seeking to have love in this life, love in these relationships, power, wealth, fame, we are seeking man's concerns, not God's. And Jesus says that God's concerns, do you realize that what Jesus was saying is that I have to die and go to the cross? And Peter rebukes him. If Jesus didn't go to the cross, Peter would not be saved. He didn't realize, but Peter was deterring or trying to deter the Son of God from doing the thing that would save Peter. And we have such a good God that he says, no, get behind me. I will not allow you to stop my mission because I want you that badly. The importance here is to note that Jesus came to suffer and die. That is what he must do. He says it himself. You know what's interesting is that Jesus says that those who seek to save their life will lose it, but those who seek to lose their life for my sake will find it. Do you realize that when Jesus lost his life, he didn't save it? I thought this was a really interesting thought. I realized this when I was studying. We read this, and it's those who seek to save their life will lose it, but those who lose it will save it. Jesus sought and must and had to lose his life, but not to save it. Jesus had to lose it, just lose it. There was nothing on the other side of salvation for him. It wasn't, well, I will lose my life and I'll be more glorified. No, he had glory. No, he had power. You know, the whole list of power, fame, wealth, love, Jesus had all of that. He had all of that in abundance, all of that in perfect fullness, and he sought to lose his life for our sake. It's only so apropos that he would call us to do exactly as he did. I lost my life for your sake. I gave up all I had. I lost my very identity so that you would have one. And I ask you to lose it all for me, to lose it all for my will, for my desires. Because, and this is the most amazing thing, that on the other side of our losing our life, life exists. On the other side of Christ losing his life, there was no life. There was hell, and there was the death that we all deserve, right? The divine justice at which we all should be under the wrath of God. See, Jesus' love, Jesus' acceptance, Jesus himself can and is already all the things that we seek in shame and honor culture, as well as individualistic culture. Jesus had the adoration of his family. He had the greatest wealth ever. He was famous. He never felt disinterest. He was rapturously caught up in the Trinity. He had all the power. He was with God and one with God. He was God and one with God. Creation all happened by his power. And finally, he had all the love he would ever need and wasn't lacking. All the ways that we seek to feel accepted, loved and needed by others, we can find in Jesus. And that's why he is telling us to seek to lose our lives for his sake and the gospel. Because why? The gospel is that. The gospel is that you cannot do it. You and I cannot do it. We seek to save our own lives. We never seek to lose our life. We never seek to lose hope or to abandon the goal of somebody loving us. But Jesus comes down and says, you don't need the love of other people. You need my love. Because I can give you all the love you ever need. You know, love is fleeting in relationships. Because not only might a person, break up with us or end a marriage or leave you or anything else. I mean, God forbid, cheat on you or you cheat on them. They can die. Love can be taken away by circumstances beyond all control. Love can be lost in this world. But do you realize that by Christ dying, when we say in marriage, I promise to love you till death do us part, right? Till death, guess what? Death parts love. Death is the end of love in the marriage vow. Okay, well, when death happens, love's over. Sorry, that's just the way it is. I promise to love you until death part us. Okay, well, that's the end game. Once you die, once I die, love's gone. But the Bible is that I promise to love you even when death happens. When death happens, I will love you still. It's not till death do us part. It's till death put us in his arms, right? Death doesn't part us from the love of God. Death puts us into his presence. Power, fame, all of that stuff that people use to rule over one another, that we use to feel good about ourselves, all the things that we say and do and act within those spans of categories, they are all taken away by death. Death ends it all. So if you seek to lose your life, guess what? You've lost fame, power, love, and wealth. It's all gone. It doesn't carry over. Except the love of Jesus Christ. Can I encourage you with that today? To know that the love of God will not ever leave you? That the love of God could never be parted? That even the most, The most scary thing that could ever happen to us, death. The most terrifying thing that could ever occur in the human life. Guess what? We all end when death happens. But God's love will never, ever end. And he proved it by conquering sin and death. That's what the gospel is. That's what the truth of seeking to lose your life for his sake and the gospel is. It's living in the response of the fact that it's not about me or what I seek to do to save myself. It's about accepting love that could never leave me and will never forsake me. When the world spat on Christ, when we killed him, he loved us still. You can't escape that. I can't escape that. Nobody could take that away from me. This is the love that will carry on when everything, including life, fails. And Jesus needs us to know it. He needs us to understand that we cannot be seeking those other loves, even within Christianity. We cannot be seeking heaven. We cannot be seeking the end game. We must be seeking him because he is the pure reality of love. C.S. Lewis says that hell is a state of mind, yes. Why? Because hell is the separation, the loneliness, and the state of which we are isolated away from the presence of God. That is what hell is. But heaven is true reality in and of itself. Because heaven is the presence of God, who is the center of all reality. And Lewis ends with this. The more we get what we now call ourselves out of the way and let him take us over, the more truly ourselves we become. Our real selves are all waiting for us in him. The more I resist him and try to live on my own, the more I become dominated by my own heredity and upbringing and surrounding and natural desires. In fact, what I so proudly call myself becomes merely the meeting place for trains of events which I never started and cannot stop. What I call my wishes become merely the desires thrown upon by my physical organism or pumped into me by other men's thoughts. It is when I turn to Christ, when I give myself up to his personality, that I can finally begin to have a real personality of my own. Nevertheless, you must not go to Christ for the sake of a new self. As long as your own personality is what you are bothering about, you are never going to him at all. We can't fool God. We can't be seeking Jesus as a means to another end. He's a king, right? He's a king. He's the ruler. He's the ruler God, the maker of all. And now, at the end of Mark 8, guess what? We close with this. Mark 8 closes and flips the book. At the end of Mark 8, the message changes. Because up to Mark 8, we've seen a king. Up to Mark 8, we've seen a ruler, a powerful figure, one who calms the storms, one who death is just sleeping. We see all of this. And at the end of Mark 8, we see a cross. We see a death. We see a suffering. We see all of this at the closing because from this point on, we flip from just seeing a king. We see a savior. We see one who will lose it all for our sake. Don't bother going to him to seek to save your life. Go to him to lose your life. Lewis also says in another place, it is far better to be lost in the identity of Jesus Christ, lost in the love, lost in heaven itself, than to be found in this world or in this life. A glimpse of heaven, a taste of the sweetness of heaven is far sweeter than the most pleasure this world could ever offer you. And I encourage you and I encourage myself today, don't seek to save your life. Seek Jesus. Let's pray. What a heavy topic, Father. What a heavy failure of my part. Hearing about you, hearing your promises, hearing your love, and yet using them as a means to my own end. What a failure I have been. What a lost cause I find myself often to be. And I am reassured because where I am a failure, you succeeded. Where I forsook you, you pronounced me. when I called out amongst the scoffers of those who put you to death, you advocated for me. This is the love we've been looking for all of our lives, and it is staring us right in the face. And I pray that we would not have the heart of the Pharisees, that we would not see the world wrong, but that we would see the world, that we would see you as what we really need. We don't need anything beyond you. We don't need anything beside you. We need you. Our whole identity must be lost in you, because only then, not even for the saving of ourselves, but only in the losing of our lives for you, can we really know what it is meant to feel love, to be who we're supposed to be everything that you intended us to be. Forgive us for the ways that we have used other things, for the way that we have used you as a means to a selfish end. And God, save us. Save us from ourselves. Give us what we don't deserve, please. And most of all, I thank you that you've done that. You died. You rose. You paid the price, and you saved me, and you saved us all. And the gospel promises that by nothing I do, by nothing I have said, by nothing I've done, day by day, I am washed. Day by day, I am saved. Day by day, I'm made new. We thank you for this promise. We thank you for your love. In your name, amen.